For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So I had a talk prepared, which I'll get to in a minute, but I sort of anticipated that we might be still feeling lots of feelings about that ceremony. So I'm going to start out with something in addition to the talk. I thought I would share the story of one of my favorite teachers, Gary Snyder, who's been involved in engaged Buddhism or environmental activism for a very long time. And in an essay in this book, Back on the Fire, which is from 2007, the essay is called Writers and the War Against Nature. And he's talking about the origins of his thinking about that part of his life, about his environmental activism. I thought that would be appropriate tonight. So one thing he talks, there's a lot of parts to it, but one thing he talks about is going to Japan to study Zen as a young man. And his Rinzai teacher taught him about the precepts and told him that the most important precept was the first precept, cause the least possible harm, and that that precept contains all the other precepts, and that is the way to live your life. And Snyder acknowledges that it's challenging to do that. But he has a lot of influences besides Buddhism. He studied Confucianism, which calls for etiquette in regard to nature. And he studied Native American practices. And many Native American cultures show deep gratitude and respect in their hunting and fishing. And he also studied science, Western science. One of my favorite comments in this essay, he refers to plants as the ultimate working class because they create all the food on the planet. They take sunlight energy and turn it into carbohydrates, and without the ultimate working class, there wouldn't be any life on Earth. So he puts all of this together and he says, we need a religious view that embraces nature and does not fear science. But preceding all of this, he had a profound experience as a boy. He grew up in the Pacific Northwest and always wanted to climb Mount St. Helens. And so when he was 15, he and another group of boys got to have that wonderful experience. And they went up with a great mentor who taught them how to climb a mountain with love, not to conquer the mountain, but to become one with the mountain. And so he did that magnificent thing and came down ecstatic. And when he got to the ranger station, it was August of 1945, and he was greeted with the news that the U.S. had just dropped two bombs on Japan, and the images of that horror were what he saw in his very opened up state, and he said it changed him forever. So he said, I swore a vow to myself, something like, by the purity and beauty of Mount St. Helens, I will fight against this cruel, destructive power and those who would seek to use it for all of my life. So that was his commitment moment, and I think it's a very powerful story that he tells, and he comes out of it with such a positive view. He says, artists, including writers, poets, dancers, cooks, need to unite with religious leaders, indigenous spiritual leaders, conservationists, and scientists, and all who truly love the world to awaken the heart of compassion in us all, which is what he thinks has to happen if we're going to change the world. So I think that's a really lovely way to think about engaged Buddhism, and it really puts everything together for me. And I really recommend this book, which is cheap. It's remaindered, so I can buy it. But anyway, thank you for that ceremony. It was very moving to me. So, Mom, the talk that I prepared is about connecting with nature in a different way. Last December, I got really, really sick, and I was in bed for, you know, whatever, 2 weeks. It was that flu that went around, and I almost couldn't, like, move for a week. And then about halfway into it, I was ready for a little bit of stimulation, and I found what I thought looked like a small book that wouldn't be too hard to read on my shelf called The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. And it didn't have too many pages and was small, so I thought I could handle it. And it turned out to be the perfect book to read because it's about a woman who is very, very sick. And not to make too light of it, because I had the flu, but she had a horrible thing that she had a virus that was attacking the mitochondria in her cells, and they couldn't cure her. They didn't understand it. And so she was a young woman. One day she was, you know, fine, and the next day she was in bed for years. So anyway, she says, I had thought I was indestructible. Given the ease with which health infuses life with meaning, it is shocking how swiftly illness steals away those certainties. It was all I could do to get through each moment, and each moment felt like an endless hour, yet days slipped silently past. Time unused and only endured still vanishes. So she was way sicker than me, but I was really identifying her, and I love this koan, time unused. What is that? Time unused and only endured still vanishes. Anyway, people were visiting her. So she couldn't live at her home, which was like a farm in Vermont or something. So she was in this apartment, and people were visiting her and bringing her flowers. And someone brought her a pot of violets that they had dug up, and in the pot was a little land snail. And it wasn't an accident. I mean, this person thought she would like a pot of violets with a snail, and she was not so thrilled with it. She said she didn't know what to do with it, and she basically didn't think it was fair to her or the snail that they were stuck with each other. So she started to make friends with this snail. And one of the really nice things about this book, and I brought some copies for people, is it has lots of... it has lots of haikus with snails in them. There's lots of haikus that people have written about snails. So here's one. The snail gets up and goes to bed with very little fuss. That's Kobayashi Issa. They're all wonderful. But anyway, the book is about her getting in relationship with the snail, I guess would be one way to put it. It's a really different creature than a human being, but she was looking at it and trying to understand what they had in common and what were different about them. So she gave it water and it drank. She didn't know what to feed it. She noticed little square holes in paper. So it turns out snails can digest cellulose, which I didn't know. It's not very common, animals that can do. So it was, but anyway, she started feeding it flowers, the people that were bringing her flowers, and she started to sort of like the snail. And in fact, she said, the snail and I were both living in altered landscapes, not of our choosing. I figured we shared a sense of loss and displacement. And after not too long, it became sort of the most important thing in her life. I mean, she wasn't up all that much. I mean, she was really sick and mostly in bed, not happily in bed relaxing, but pretty much sick. And so, but when she was awake, she sort of focused on the snail, and she said, it was adding a welcome focus to my life. Interesting. Anyway, she said, watching the snail was completely relaxing. I observed without thinking. That's sort of interesting, observing without thinking. To me, it was like I try to do Tai Chi without thinking, and then it's really relaxing. I try to do Zazen without thinking, and then it's relaxing. Anyway, her experience was watching the snail. So anyway, there's actually a plot here. So she says, whereas the energy of my human visitors wore me out, the snail inspired me. Its curiosity and grace pulled me further into its peaceful and solitary world. And so she was really, just like Gary Snyder said, you know, we really have to respect and honor the rest of the world. She was sort of doing that through this snail. So here's an example of a difference between snails and us. So snails only have the senses of touch, taste, and smell. They don't hear and they can't see. So she decided she would read Helen Keller's book to help her understand the snail. I thought that was sort of a brilliant thing to do. And she didn't talk too much about it, but I was impressed that she was that it was a thoughtful thing to do. So you know, you probably haven't thought too much about snails. I haven't thought too much about snails. They're really impressive creatures. They've been around for half a billion years. And I mean, that's one of the most successful animals ever in the history of the world. And they're pretty much small, and they've been studied by a lot of people over time. And I mentioned that, you know, there are a lot of haikus about them, but there's also lots of writing about them from the 18th century, 19th century. I don't know, their strangeness is compelling to people, but there was a story that she found from the 1800s, a scientific account. I guess it was an experiment. I don't know, we do all kinds of experiments on other creatures. Two snails were put in a garden, and a very poor garden, and one of the snails was sick and the other was strong, and the strong one went and found a better garden and then came back and got the weak one and brought him. So, and here's a quote from 1899. This one will knock your socks off, I hope. The emotional natures of snails, as far as love and affection are concerned, seem to be highly developed, and they show plainly by their actions when courting the tenderness they feel for each other. That is from a book called The Dawn of Reason in 1899. So anyway, snails don't need to mate to reproduce. So her snail started laying eggs one day, which was amazing to her, and laid 118 eggs, which hatched into miniature snails. And so she finally decided she probably should not have them all in her apartment and release them and release the... She never named the snail. She thought it was too much of a human thing to name the snail. But... And she was actually also getting a little better, but so she let the snail out into her garden and let the babies out, and it was sort of the end of the story. But she says at the end, "So I could have never guessed what would get me through this past year, a woodland snail and its offspring. I honestly don't think I would have made it otherwise. Watching another creature go about its life somehow gave me, the watcher, purpose too." So it was a lovely thing to read when I was sick, and I haven't really stopped thinking about it, and I probably won't ever think about snails differently. I mean, I probably won't think about snails the same, but I'm going to end with a poem by Gary Snyder, who's you probably noticed my favorite As the cricket's soft autumn hum is to us, so are we to the trees, as are they to the rocks and hills. Thank you. And I want to pass out the extra copies of the haikus, because they're quite lovely. And I didn't feel like I should read them, but maybe you would like to read them.
Would you read a few more of the haikus for us, then?
Okay.
Please?
I'll keep one and pass some. Oh, here's a really good one. Climb Mount Fuji, O snail, but slowly, slowly. That's a good one. Okay, here's one more, and then someone else can read one. Closing the door, he drops off to sleep. Snail. That's a wonderful one. I don't know, what do people make of the fact that, do you know, is there a reason why there are so many haikus about snails?
They're interesting animals.
Yes, they're interesting animals. There's no animal that's not interesting.
This is just a guess, but is it because they're such slow-moving creatures that sort of, mirrors Zen practice or so?
I'm sure that's true. I mean, her observations about time and how, when she was watching the snail and when she was sick, then people just seemed to be moving way too fast. It's like faster than seemed healthy or sane or something. Just massively fast. It seemed jarringly fast. But I don't know.
When we just sit, we slow down and we can appreciate some other creatures that are slower than our usual pace.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, the snail was a little bit like a meditation tool. I mean, what's the right word? Like a koan would be, or a mantra would be. Her snail was her meditation. What's the right word? Helper. Although she was in a particularly distressed situation.
Dawn.
So, Anne-Marie can't have furry pets, so she wants hermit crabs. Basil took her into the store and said, "Oh, she'll stand there for 10 minutes and watch them first before we."
Before you adopted it?
Before you think about it. You could. And she did. She's like, "Yep, yeah, that's." and we actually got some from Chris. His sister brought them from Pennsylvania on this van ride, and they were actually kind of fun, to watch, because they do have a very active time, but it is very slow. She would take them out and set up obstacle courses for to go. But it was kind of this thing for her, because she can't have like a snuggly dog or whatever, but she would still make do with this thing, and she's four things, and still like have this situation with them and set them up and have the right environment. She had things going on, and I thought it was really cool that she still found a way to do that, even though it wasn't maybe like a guinea pig or something different. And now she has a tarantula, and that's been the same thing. Just watching her and watching her do her thing, and because she's also slow, but she's not just running around that, you know, weird aquarium. And so really kind of, you know, showing her and the love and, like, kind of connecting. She's right by her bed, and she kind of has certain things for her and certain things she knows, and it's just kind of a neat relationship to watch. So, I like the book.
Yeah, I think kids do learn about compassion from their friends, I mean, from their pets, and they really, they get into their pets' heads in a way that sometimes adult people aren't as good at. Because they sort of pay attention to them in a way that they understand that they're not just randomly doing stuff, they actually are doing reasonable things for their life and well-being.
I don't want to be a downer, but if that was a boy that age, it would very quickly be the tarantula against the hermit crabs. I mean, I've experienced this. I know it's different animals. But
and who would win?
Well, you know, well, I don't know. Probably the hermit crabs, actually. But the those tarantulas are very sensitive. They can get hurt very easily. But the hermit crabs have since gone. We do one thing at a time, usually. We try to keep it one thing.
Just to consider beings that are very different from us is interesting and instructive to actually. I don't know if it's natural or instinctive to draw back from something that seems alien or different, but if we can actually look at and consider, so snail is not so threatening, so it's a good example.
It's, to me, one of the most provocative things to think about is having been around for 500 million years. I mean, we haven't been around for very long compared to that. That's sort of humbling. And I don't know, my perspective gets changed pretty dramatically when I think about that as best I can.
There's something, I see it's hard to get one's, even to know what to say about it, but, you know, I experienced this sometimes working with, you know, bees, but I also remember, this guy I met at the jail, like the first year I was there, and, you know, had a spider up in his corner of his window that he watched, and, you know, it sounded very much the same kind of thing. There's just something kind of, it's not dramatic, but it's still kind of humbling and awe-inspiring to see, you know, I mean, bugs know what they're up to. They know what they're doing, and they've been doing it, as you say, very successfully. Successfully for a very long time in a much quieter and less damaging way than we often behave, and it's humbling and inspiring.
The discussion of bugs makes me think about Microcosmos, a documentary that I hope everybody has seen. If not, it's definitely well worth checking out. It's by a French filmmaker. They use these cameras that they can go amazingly small. And please, if you haven't seen Microcosmos, check it out. I wanted to ask you about the... I'm a little surprised by this second line in the Gary Snyder... I just wondered, Laurel, if you would tell me what your response is to... He says, as the cricket's soft autumn hum is to us, so are we to the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what comes up for you when you read that line, so are we to the trees.
The reason I love that poem so much is we usually have everything from the human perspective, and so he's looking at what humans are from the trees' perspective and what trees are to the rocks' perspective, I just love shifting my focus as best I can, you know, based on his pushing that way. I mean, trees experience us the way we experience crickets. I love that. I never thought about what a tree experienced of me, let alone all the people rushing around doing all the things we're doing, all this tree. That, did you experience something different from that? I mean, were you thinking of it differently from that?
Yeah, I was thinking the trees might have less, I don't know, their experience of humans might be less enjoyable, perhaps, than our experience of the crickets hum.
Aha. So maybe he's thinking of not necessarily the tree out in front of the temple that's been nearly massacred by the construction process. Yeah, I was picturing, maybe I was picturing trees on Mount St. Helens with the boys climbing by or something. I mean, in the history of the world, most trees haven't been in cities, but yeah, trees in cities may experience us more like hornets or something.
Well, this might be just in terms of, you know, lifespan or something, but I was just reading today a book actually that you gave me from Aldo Leopold talking about thinking like a mountain.
Oh, yeah.
And how...
yeah, that's another one of shifting perspective.
Yeah, he talks about wolves and how... For farmers and for many people, you know, wolves are hunted because and to protect the deer, to protect. But actually, from the mountains' perspective, if the wolves are eliminated, then the deer are going to decimate the woodlands of the of the mountains. So it just shifted. You know, what is it like? And then there's a book by Joanna Macy about thinking like a mountain. And. And Dogen talks about sort of people, mountains love the people who love them. Or, anyway, what is it like to sit like a mountain? And anyway, shifting perspective is a large part of our practice. So there's something in this poem about that. How do we shift our perspective to not just be caught in human realm all the time? Sort of befriend a snail, sort of.
Yeah, and the snail helped her a lot.
So I saw the poem as more like sort of like lifespan in a way. I mean, it's the crickets in the autumn, and people see the crickets come and go each year, but the trees have a longer life. Mm-hmm. And they see people come and go, and the mountains see the trees come and go. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting approach because it puts people into nature. Outside watching, you're part of the cyclical nature of how we're coming and going. It's more slowly in comparison to the crickets, but more quickly than the trees or rocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And part of the problem, excuse me, for, you know, with nuclear power and all these problems is that we think we are separate and outside of nature, and we can control things and we can do whatever we want, and we forget that we're part of the whole of this process. We're part of creation.
And there's a lot bigger time scale to be thinking about, even for our own species, than just the span of our lifetimes, you know, then right. Stuff's going to be around for long.
Yeah.
Jim, did you?
A couple of things I was thinking of extending it further as rocks are to the sun, or as smaller critters are to the grasshoppers. There's an old limerick. It's a good one to forget right now. But there's a thing in Pascal about being suspended properly and being friendly.
Louder, please.
About being suspended
corpus and the being, somewhere between the infinitely large and the infinitely small. And it's only inside of left field because we've been concentrating on the movement, on even the case of the snail, the dynamism of the snail. But I was thinking you were asking about why people are fascinated, and may very well be entirely by the snail in motion.
Yeah.
But there's something about the form, after all. Because a snail is a combination of a fluidity and amorphousness that's really on the edge of not having any form at all. And on the other hand, this other crystalline element, more like a mineral, which I guess is... could also be considered a combination of the most vulnerable and fleeting element, again, just on the edge of falling apart or rotting or whatever. And on the other hand, the most resistant, hard, and durable. It shows up in the fossil bones.
So, that's really interesting. She wrote this book after she got well, which was 10 years later or something, and she did a bunch of research, which she hadn't done when she was sick. She was mostly just watching it. So it is filled with all these unbelievably peculiar bits of natural history. Like, there's a whole page about slime, which, you know, sort of sounds disgusting, except it's so fascinating because it turns out that there's a whole bunch of different chemical formulas that they make for slime for different purposes. Which, you know, some is for reproduction and some is for transportation and some is for... there's like 10 different slime formulas that they're able to... It's just stunningly foreign and interesting.
Those wonderful creatures, the slime balls.
Right. Anyway, so her perspective is not... She was too sick to actually write. Her perspective is really of a well person looking back at how that experience was. Interesting one.
Jeremy?
Yeah, thank you. I have a question. I wanted to know your response, and this is a problem I run into a lot, is how to engage the full conversation of nature. It's a tall task, but it needs to be done. I feel like when we talk, and this is not to put, you know, the beauty of the snail down. The snail's a very, you know, non-assuming, non-threatening creature. But if you take something like a flesh-eating bacteria or something like a shark or something that's maybe more, you know, not glamorous, you know, I feel like too often people say, let's save the world, and we think of pretty things, but we're not thinking of the full struggle that life really is. Even the struggle that we all will eventually encounter at the end, you know, when maybe we have a virus attacking us or a cancer or something like that. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Perhaps. Well, if you're asking, I thought I heard you ask, see if this is right, how do you engage people in the accepting
exactly.
or relating to the full spectrum of life on Earth, which some of it's ugly and some of it's painful and some of it's disgusting.
Whatever. Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I just feel like most people are so oblivious to anything non-human or not their pet that just getting people to pay attention to any part of it is the hard part. And once they get engaged, then I guess they'll follow their interest. But I don't know. I mean, if you can't get people to even like squirrels, you know, they want to like call the people with the traps. I don't know. It's tough. We're not... I mean,
we're sort of taught the opposite. So I think sitting meditation is as good as any of a way to get people to sort of wake up and notice there's something else in the world besides themselves and their television or something. I don't know. Are you talking about your students?
Yeah, but I think as a whole, in order, you know, you brought up the word respect, to respect nature. I feel like it's wonderful, and it's a great vow because of the whole encompassing participation that it requires to accept the sides that are totally like us and totally unlike us and totally nothing like we've ever thought before, and you know, this whole huge, you know, wondrous thing that's occurring all the time.
It occurs to me, another Aldo Leopold sentence I came across yesterday or today was something about, I'm not going to get it exactly right, but life is worthless or something like that. I forget what, exactly how he says it, without fear.
Hmm.
Without fear, life is not, is meaningless or something like that. He's saying we should, that life includes the fear of that which is dangerous, the wolf or whatever. And yet, you know, it seems to me that actually in our culture people are fascinated by zombies and vampires and, you know, something about that is actually, we need that. There seems to be some desire for that element. Maybe we don't have that enough. We don't have predators, actually, non-human predators. I don't know. Yes.
I know a lot of slow creatures, such as turtles. So they can also, at least in some moment, usually inspired by fear or just the need to get something done very quickly. There's at least in some aspect they can move very quickly, and I wondered if snails could do that also. I mean, I know a snapping turtle may look like it's not moving very much, but if you put your finger too near its mouth, it might bite it off before you could move away. And can the snail, I don't know, retract into its shell very quickly?
Yeah, that's like what that? They do. They get into their shell. They're very good at, so like if it's a drought or something, they can just go dormant for a while. They'll just hang out until the conditions get better again, which, you know, we can't do that.
Mm-hmm. That might be a good thing if we could do that. But
yeah. So yeah, I don't think they can ever run fast. I mean, mm-hmm. at least I'm not a snail expert, but I read this book. but I know they can, yeah, they just take all their soft parts and they can lock up their operculum, the entrance.
Sort of mucous membrane kind of thing.
Yeah.